We nominated Mitt Romney. Why? Oh, Romney's the most electable, and he lost. We nominated McCain. He was the most electable. We lost. So people who think, oh, we should nominate someone who's the most electable, here's what my two cents is. The most electable is the person who's the best person to be president. And if you decide that someone is the best person to be president, my guess is they're going to have the best chance to win the election. And so I would just keep it to that. Who's the person who has the skill and has the vision and to take this country in a direction that you believe is necessary? And I trust Iowans. People ask me all the time, why did I spend so much time here? Why aren't you raising money? Why aren't you doing all these things? Because I'm going to speak to Iowans, and I'm going to trust them instead of the funders who I have to go to raise all these dollars. And then, as you see, much more accountable to them than I am to people that I'm standing in front of here tonight. And so I'll stop right there and be happy to take whatever questions you have that will help you decide the candidate you should support.
What would you do on the southern border as far as the stem that tide of illegal immigration coming across?
Questions on the southern border. That is a key part of a larger issue, which is our immigration system. The reason the southern border is a problem is because, number one, we haven't had a president who has the will to fix it. I introduced a bill 10 years ago, which was a border security bill, way long before this became the hot button issue it is today. And I said at that time I laid out a detailed plan of how we could secure the southern border, having talked to some of the best when I was in the Senate, the best and brightest. Now, that was 10 years ago, and my guess is there's different technologies and different ways of doing it. But the bottom line is you need a president who has the will to do it. I have been for securing the southern border ever since it became an issue, even before it was an issue. But that's only part of the problem. The southern border is a problem because we have incentives for people to cross that border. And we have to turn off the incentives. And the first incentive we have to turn off is the ability to work in this country illegally. And that's why we need to adopt a mandatory E-Verify system to make sure that everybody in this country who's working for business is working for a business legally. And so every business has to have E-Verify to check their employees. Number two, we have to have a system that removes people from this country who are here, came here legally, but have overstayed their visas. Everyone talks about 12 million people being in this country, and what are we going to do with all these people who are in this country illegally? Half of them, some say more than half, some say less, but roughly half of them came here legally. They came here on a student visa, they came here on a work visa, they came here on a visitor visa, and they didn't go home. They're from all over the world. Most of them actually have done very well. And there's no reason not to go home other than the fact they like America more. And so my feeling is you made a promise when you came to this country. You signed a document. You said you would go home, and you're not going home. You need to go home. And here's the easy part. We know who they are because they came in this country, so we know their names. We know probably where they are, what area of the country they're in. And we know fairly quickly to be able to track them down and communicate with them. Most of them have stayed in communication. I hear from people all the time, the State Department tells people they don't have to go home. They tell people that there's no reason for them to leave because we're not going to deport you. We need to send out the message, time to go home. And if you want to come back, we're not going to prejudice you. You can come back through the regular visa process or regular immigration process like everybody else. You've now solved half of the immigration problem. But you start enforcing the law, getting rid of sanctuary cities. I find it remarkable that 300 city councils in America, mayors in America, can nullify a federal law. You hear the word nullification, you think of slavery. Well, don't think of slavery, think of immigration, because that's what 300 cities are doing right now. They're nullifying federal law, saying we don't have to obey the law. One city clerk in Kentucky does it, they throw her in jail. 300 cities do it, they celebrate. We need to have a laws enforced in this country, and that means any city that is a sanctuary city will lose all federal funds because you either comply with federal statutes or you suffer the consequences that are available to the federal government to encourage you to comply with federal law. So birthright citizenship is another one. I believe the Constitution is very clear that the 14th Amendment says that you are a citizen of the United States if you are born in this country, and you're subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And so what does that mean? Well, who has the determination as to whether you are a citizen or not? That's the Congress. Article 1, Section 8 gives Congress the right to determine this. It's very clear. Think about it. In 1789, when they passed the Constitution, there were no American citizens. Why? Because there was no United States. So the Congress had to determine in 1789 who's a citizen. De novo. I mean, who are we going to qualify? Who's going to be eligible to vote? Who's going to be eligible for all the rights and privileges that come under the Constitution? The Congress made that decision in 1789. The Constitution gave them the power. And so going forward, that's always been the Congress has a right to determine who's a citizen or not. And that's what the 14th Amendment just basically ratified, in my opinion. So I believe that the Congress should say that people who are not born here, who are born here when neither parent is an American citizen or here legally, you are not a citizen of this country. If you're here born to someone who parents who are illegal, you do not get automatic citizenship. So that's part of the problem. Okay? Then you have the issue of amnesty. What are you going to do with the other folks who are here in this country that came here illegally? And this is where I separate myself out from, I think, everybody in the field. Everybody in the field wants to allow people to stay here one way or another. Now, some will say, well, once the border's secured, we'll let them stay. Either way, they're going to let people stay, and they're not going to remove them at any time. So ultimately, everybody that's here, and that's every single Republican with maybe, and I say maybe, because I know you're going to find this hard to believe, but this candidate has had multiple opinions on this issue, and that's Donald Trump, who's been, you know, we're going to throw them all out, and, you know, and then we're going to throw, but we're going to keep the good ones, and then, you know, we're going to let them come out and just come right back in, and I mean, it's just some of the, it just makes no sense. Right. Well, yeah, but, you know, he wants more people to come in, and but he has said that we want to keep the good ones. So we're not going to throw the good ones out. Now, I don't know who determines the good ones and the bad ones. But if he's saying, we'll just throw the criminals out, well, Obama's doing that. And that's no different than what Obama's doing. So I don't know what his opinion is on this. I think he's rather fluid on the issue. I'm very clear. If you're in this country illegally, you got to go home. And you know, we have a process in this country where people have waited, in some cases, 20 years to come in this country legally, and we shouldn't reward people who have broken the law to come here and give them the same stature. I just think it's wrong. And people say, well, what are you going to do? You're going to break up families. My father was an immigrant to this country. He came here when he was 7 years old. But the first 7 years of his life, he lived without his father. Why? Because my grandfather immigrated to this country by himself. He was allowed to come in, and this family was not. And that goes back to the 1921 Immigration Act, which basically barred Italians from coming into the country. It barred Italians from coming into the country. My father was Italian. My grandfather was not. You say, well, how is that? How can my father be Italian and my grandfather not be Italian? Because when my grandfather was born in 1888, the area of Italy that my father lived in was not part of Italy. It was part of Austria. And after the First World War, it became part of Italy. So after the First World War, my dad was born. He was Italian, but his father was Austrian. So they were from the same town. And so my grandfather could come in because he had an Austrian passport, not an Italian passport. But he couldn't bring the family in because they were all Italians. Yes. Go figure it out. And so he had to wait 7 years. And I might ask my dad, did you ever resent the fact that America, you know, because it was clearly prejudiced against Italians. I mean, that was the reason. It was Italians and Jews. They didn't want any more Italians and Jews coming into this country. And that's what the 21 Immigration Act was all about. I said, "Did you ever resent that?" He said, "No, America was worth the wait." And I think it is. It is worth the wait. And so, again, I differentiate myself on the issue of amnesty. Everybody else. Now, you'll hear people say, "Oh, no, I'm going to be tough." Read the fine print. Because every one of them, whether it's Ben Carson or Ted Cruz or whoever it is, who all say, "Oh, no, we're not going to let people, become citizens." That's not the issue. The question is whether they're going to be legal permanent residents. And they all let them become legal permanent residents either immediately or after the border's secured. Either way, they're not sending them home. And once the border's secured, they're legal here for the rest of their lives. I believe that's wrong. And that differentiates me from everybody else. And plus, one other thing, legal immigration, which I also think is a bigger problem, because you're talking about a situation where we're bringing in 1,050,000 people a year into this country, a country that right now is not creating a lot of low-wage worker jobs. 90% of the people coming into this country are low-wage workers, and we have the lowest labor participation rate in 40 years. Wages in this country have gone basically nowhere in 20 years. The lowest wage growth in any 20-year period in American history, and that includes the Depression. And we want to bring in 1 million more people a year. In fact, we are. Here's an interesting stat. Between now and the year 2050, if you don't bring any more people in, America will grow by 14 million people. That's it. Now, that's not enough. So we do need immigration. But you know how many people will grow just from the people who come into this country and their children between now and 2050 for the next 33 years? 110 million people. Just give me an idea. We have 330 million people in America today. If we keep the immigration pace up as we have now, we will increase this country by another third, almost all of which will be foreign-born from all over the world. So you can say that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's the policy we have right now. I have concerns because a quarter of those people are coming through something called the visa lottery system and chain migration. They're coming from third world countries, most of whom are hostile to America, and then their family members can come after they win the lottery. Because of a system called chain migration, they can bring all of their family members and extended family members over. That is no way to run an immigration system. And so I want to get rid of those two programs and leave the rest of the immigration system not exactly like it is. I'd make some other changes. Again, no one else supports that. Everyone else, folks who you think are tough on immigration, Ted Cruz, tough on immigration, he wants to double the number of legal immigrants coming into the country. H-1B visas. Have you heard about those? The highly skilled worker visas? Well, it turns out they're not highly skilled workers at all. 80% of the people who come in under the H-1B program are 5 wage categories. 80% are the bottom 2 wage categories. They're basically computer programmers. Actually, 2 Disney employees just spoke up about this. Actually went public the other day. But there is a famous case of Disney, which went out and hired 700 people to come into this country, had the people who worked in these jobs train these people. The people working these jobs were making $105,000 a year. They trained these 700 Indians. They were all from India. Trained 700 Indians to come in, and then they fired all those workers, and the Indians worked for $62,000 a year. Okay? Now, again, just the facts. Ted Cruz wants to increase that program by 500%. He wants to go from $65,000 a year to $330,000 a year. Okay? I know a lot of people around talk about how conservative they are and all these things. Look at the record. Look at what they want. Not what they say, but what they do. And I can go through, I just mentioned Cruz because he's the most egregious, but there's a lot of others who talk tough on immigration, and they're simply not. And they've been called out by this. If you have any questions about it, you can go to numbersusa.com, and they list all this information.
Would you force employers to up the wage on the H-1B so they...
I would eliminate the low worker. I would eliminate the bottom category and make it a higher skilled worker. I'm all for higher skilled workers to come here and work. There's almost 1 million of them in this country right now. And remember, we let in 65,000 a year, but they can stay. So we have 800,000 of them right now who are, and most of them are lower skilled tech workers. That's why less than 50% of STEM workers, you even know the term STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, 50% of STEM workers, folks who graduate from college with a science, technology, engineering, or math degree, are not in their field of study. Can't find a job in their field of study. Why? Because we have a lot of folks coming in from overseas to do it. And again, I'm pro-immigrant. I'm the son of an immigrant. I think immigration is good, but we have to look at it as the impact on America and American workers. Yes?
Can we realistically do anything about deficit spending?
Another big issue. Two things you can do about deficit spending. You know what the two things are? You can raise revenue, and you can cut spending. Those are two things you can do. And, okay, let's look at the spending side. What percentage of the federal government is entitlement programs, mandatory spending programs, Medicare, Social Security, welfare, Medicaid, food stamps, all these different programs? What percentage, and interest on the debt, what percentage of all federal spending are those programs? Give me a number.
80%.
73. 71%. 71%. So, and what's the rest? Well, half of the rest, which is 29%, roughly half of the rest is defense spending. Then the other half is all of government. I mean, all of what we consider government, all the departments. You know, the Justice Department, the Interior Department, the Agriculture Department. Everything else is 12 to 14% of the federal government is the federal government, as you know it. It's the federal government has become one huge transfer payment processor and interest payment processor. And what, of course, the three biggest programs of the federal government? Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, Medicaid. Now, where do most of the money go for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? You know this, seniors. So Social Security is, I don't know what the number is, but my guess is it's about 80 to 90% of Social Security dollars are spent on seniors. The rest is spent on disability, which are not seniors. Medicare is almost all seniors. There's a small portion. Medicare covers for people with disabilities. And then Medicaid. Everybody thinks Medicaid, well, that's just, that's health care for poor people. That's true. But where's most of the Medicaid dollars spent? It's spent on... No. Nursing homes. So the biggest piece of the Medicaid budget is actually seniors. So the three programs, the three biggest programs, all dramatically affect seniors. It's the reason they're the three biggest programs, because seniors are the most powerful voting bloc in America. And so it's really difficult to go out and talk about changes in programs that affect seniors. Because seniors vote, and they don't like changes to their programs, and I understand that. So how do we fix this problem? Because you saw the sequester that was put in place that this budget agreement yesterday just lifted, well, lifted some of it. That's what I mean. We saw for 3 years in a row after the sequester was put in place that the spending on the 29% of the budget actually did not go up. Now, the rest of the budget went up because all these things go up. Social Security doesn't go up that much. It just goes up with inflation plus people. So that, now the disability program does, but the retirement program doesn't. The program that's growing faster and is going to eclipse Social Security, if it hasn't already, is Medicare. Okay? Now, let's talk about these programs. Is anybody, okay, so there's two ways, and by the way, Social Security runs out of money. After this agreement, it's going to run out of money probably in 10 years, 10 to 12 years max. Social Security runs out of money. When it runs out of money, it'll be able to pay 75 cents on the dollar in benefits. That's what's going to happen. Medicare runs out of money sooner, and Medicaid is not on a budget. Medicaid, we just pay whatever it is. So let's look at Social Security. There's two ways to fix Social Security. It's the biggest program in the federal government. Okay? So you have Social Security expenses up here. I'm talking starting about a year or two. Right now, Social Security is in a surplus, but just barely. But starting in a couple years, it'll be in a deficit. The boomers are still retiring, and there's not as many workers coming into the workforce. And so you have more and more people. You know, the fastest group of age group, fastest growing age group in America, are people over the age of 100. Okay? I mean, people are living longer. So you have 10 years from now, you have expenditures up here and revenues down here. How do you bring those lines together? What do you have to do? You have to either cut benefits or increase taxes. Okay. How many people are for cutting Social Security benefits? Raise your hand. Wow. That's an unusually high number. Three. How many are for increasing Social Security taxes? Raise your hand. Okay. Now you know why we can't fix Social Security. Because nobody wants to do either. Well, if nobody wants to do either, how do you fix it? Right? You're the American public. This is your problem. It's not my problem. It's your problem. You know, and I'm asking you to help me fix it, and none of you want to do anything. So, okay, so how many are for doing nothing and in 10 years paying seniors 75 cents of every dollar there? Raise your hand if you're for that.
That'll help.
There you go.
Yeah.
Right? So this is the tough question. And that's why Medicare is a much easier problem to solve. Not because it's easier to solve. It's actually much harder to solve. But it's easier to solve because it's complex. And therefore, you can fix it, and people aren't going to know what you're really doing. Because it's just very Medicare is a very, it's a healthcare system. It's hard to understand. And so changes to it are not going to be apparent to you. But when I say we're going to cut your benefit by this, I know how much you're cutting me. Because it's dollar. You get dollars. If I'm saying I'm going to increase your taxes by this, oh, I know how much that costs me. If I say I'm going to change the system from a system that is a premium support model that will pay 28% of the average cost of and I go through my solution, you're going to look at me and say, oh, okay, that sounds all right. I have no idea how it impacts me. That makes it easy, right? Social Security is hard because it's simple. It's either pay more, get less. So here's my solution. I have several of them. But one, I think, is, well, when Social Security was put in place, what was life expectancy?
65.
61. Normal eligibility age was 65, but life expectancy was 61. That was 1936. Anybody know what life expectancy is today? Close to 80. Close to 80, right? What is normal eligibility age under Social Security today? 66 in a couple of months or something like that. Okay, it's going up to 67. Now, how many of you knew that Social Security eligibility age was moving from 65 to 67? How many knew that? Most of you do? Okay. Let me ask you this question. Who was the president who made that law change?
Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. Now, everybody loves Ronald Reagan. How did Ronald Reagan get away with raising the retirement age of Social Security and still being popular? Because he waited 20 years to do it. And so he was long gone, and nobody knew he did it. Because most people, and I asked you, none of you know, so you don't blame me, right? So here's what we need to do with Social Security. Life expectancy goes up about 1 month every 2 years in America. So what my plan is that we tie the eligibility age to Social Security to life expectancy. And so every time life expectancy goes up in America, the eligibility age goes up in America. Why? That way, every future generation of seniors will get the same amount of money as the next generation, because everybody will be the same amount of time, right? Because eligibility, because, right, as people live longer, then you move it up, so everybody gets, even though it's gradually going higher, it's still every generation gets the same amount of time on Social Security. Does anybody think that's unfair?
There is a problem with that system. And that is people like mechanics do hard labor, their bodies deteriorate, walking on concrete, and that sort of thing.
But they're eligible for disability.
Well, then you'd have to change it.
No, the disability law would still be in place. So if someone, let's say you're moving the eligibility age from 66 to, let's say, 50 years from now, it's 70.
So at 66, they're still in good shape. But maybe 70, they aren't.
Well, they're eligible. And remember, the early eligibility age is still 4 years before the regular eligibility age. So the early eligibility age in America, how many people think someone who's 62 years old is old? Raise your hand.
Depends on the day.
But you know, at 62, what percentage of Americans take Social Security at 62? 75%. Does anybody think, in a time when we are hemorrhaging money, have no money to pay our Social Security benefits, that we should be paying people Social Security benefits at 62? Anybody agree? Anybody think, well, maybe we should change that? We should move that eligibility age up too? So you do those two things, you don't solve the whole problem, but you solve a big part of the problem. The second thing we have to do, and this is, you know, there's a lot of little things we can do. For example, and this is a more recent phenomenon, but if you are the dependent of a senior, you're eligible for Social Security. So that made sense. 1936, you had people who were 65 who were old, and that was old in 1936, and you had a dependent child who was 17, 18 years of age, maybe a child later in life. Well, you know, then we, you know, that person probably couldn't work, and so we helped provide money. Now, who are most of the people who are on Social Security dependent benefits? No, I'm not talking about the disabled. I'm talking about dependent benefits. They're children of older men who have younger wives and marry, most of whom are wealthy, and have younger wives and have kids. So Strom Thurmond's kids got Social Security. Right? When he was having kids when he was 70-some years old. So as soon as they were born, they signed up for Social Security. Warren Buffett, if he got married again and had a kid, you know, whatever, Donald Trump or whatever, their kids would be eligible for Social Security. Does that make sense? Everybody think that's a good idea? It's a terrible idea. So we need to means test some of these benefits, particularly dependent benefits in the world today. So that's just some ideas. But the answer is we have to take every one of these entitlement programs and we have to start finding savings in these programs. Otherwise, we're not being serious about it. And you have some candidates, I won't mention, one talked about it at length, can't touch Social Security, seniors earn their benefits. No one's talking about taking money away from seniors who need their benefits. We're talking about future generations, or we're talking about means testing higher income seniors who don't need the benefits, people like Warren Buffett and, you know, Donald Trump and other folks like that. Yes, sir.
Talking about that much money.
this comes back to a difference I have with many conservatives. I'm a constitutionalist, and I believe that the Constitution is very clear who has the power of the purse. And who is that?
Congress.
But we went through a movement in the conservative realm the last 5 or 6 years about denying Congress the power to spend money. And it was something that was euphemistically called earmarks. That Congress shouldn't be able to earmark money. Well, I would make the argument that Congress has the right to spend the money. That's what the Constitution says. And so if Congress doesn't earmark money, the Congress says, doesn't say, well, this money will be spent for this purpose. Who decides where that money's spent?
President
and a whole bunch of bureaucrats who you know nothing about and have no accountability to you. And so I know it was a big move to say, oh, we're going to be able to cut spending if we get rid of these earmarks. Well, that simply is not the case. I think that there is no accountability in Washington, in part because the Congress doesn't have the ability to oversee spending and change that spending anymore. And I think that's a problem. I think we give too much power to the president in America today. And more importantly, we give way too much power to the bureaucracy. All of these little pet programs are decided by some deputy secretary of something who can make these decisions instead of by political folks who are much more accountable to the American public as to how those money is spent. So the answer is, how do you get rid of them? The Congress has to get rid of them. But the Congress, since they can't earmark, can only cut a function. So they can say to the Department of Agriculture, we're going to reduce the amount of spending in this area by this much because we don't like what you're doing here, here, and here. But they can't force the Department of Agriculture to change their spending because we've taken away the power of the Congress to direct money in the executive branch. And I think that's a mistake. Yeah.
If you as president want to appoint a particular do-nothing board, there's nobody to give money to.
Well, boards and commissions, that's a separate issue. I mean, one is how the money is spent by the executive agencies, everything from the Department of Defense to all the other departments. As far as there are, you're right, I don't even know how many, boards, commissions, some of which are very active and legitimate. Others are, for a variety of different functions that, you're right, meet on an irregular basis. Some are paid, some are not paid. Clearly one of the things we would do as part of our assessment of where to cut in government is to look at some of these boards, commissions, and the like and determine whether they're serving any useful purpose and whether the money is appropriate, money allocated for them is appropriate. For example, there's a commission on religious liberty, international religious liberty. Some people, presidents, tried to sort of get rid of that. I think that's actually a pretty valuable thing. But some people would say it's not valuable. So there are all sorts of commissions and boards out there that are pets for different groups of people in America, including agriculture, by the way. Lots of them. Got lots of boards and commissions, the potato board and the tomato board and all these different folks that oversee things. Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask you about the separation of powers. Our Constitution doesn't give the judicial branch of government the power to repeal a law or to amend a law or to create a new law, but that is a privilege they've asserted for themselves, and the other two branches of government have accepted it. So as president, you would be the chief executive, the executive branch of government. What would be your approach to that?
I'll answer your question in the context of the most recent Supreme Court decision of same-sex marriage. We have 14 Republican candidates for president. 14. All but four have said, when the ruling came down, all but four said, it's the law of the land, it's time to move on. All but four. 10 of the 14, including the two frontrunners in Iowa, said, it's the law of the land, it's time to move on, we don't need to discuss this anymore. Now, why do I bring this up? Because this decision is exactly the decision, one of the decisions where this gentleman was just referring to. which is a decision that the court made, which is beyond their constitutional authority to make. Justice Roberts said, there is no constitutional basis for this decision. They took an opportunity to create a constitutional right out of nothing, out of no historical precedent. And I believe it is the obligation of the other branches of government to do what was anticipated in this theory, constitutional theory, called checks and balances, which is the idea that if one branch of government exceeds its authority, then the other branches of government have an obligation to check that branch. The authority the Supreme Court has is an authority called judicial review. Now, where in the Constitution is the term judicial review? Anybody know what article it's in? You're correct. It's not anywhere in the Constitution of the United States. There's no provision in the Constitution for judicial review. Now, some would say it's implied. I might accept that. That there the concept of if there is a dispute about the constitutionality of a law, who would decide that? It would sort of make sense that a court would be the one that would look at and determine what is constitutional. But there's no specific authority for them to do it. They took authority to do that in a very famous case called Marbury versus Madison. So where this all comes from, not all of it, again, there's some implied in the historical precedent in the past, not in the United States, but other countries. So Marbury versus Madison, there was a contested issue. Thomas Jefferson, I think, was the president at the time. And they decided the issue in favor of the federal government. So the crisis was averted, but by deciding it in favor of the government, they said, we have the authority to do it. And from that point on, this principle of judicial review has been in place. And I support it. The Supreme Court needs to be in a position of making these calls. You know, for example, in the Obama decision that we're seeing right now, the Supreme Court has stepped in, and not Supreme Court, courts have stepped in and said, you know, the president is exceeding his authority and the way he's regulating and changing the law with Obamacare. That's an appropriate place. But it doesn't give them the authority to do whatever they want. And that's, you know, I was with Mark Levin the other day, who I'm now, I understand, is 2 minutes away from my interview. And Mark has an idea. Did you ever read the Liberty Amendments? These are ideas that Mark Levin's put forward. One of them is to give the Congress the power with three-fifths vote, so 60 votes in the Senate and 60% in the House, to overturn a Supreme Court decision. So we'd give an amendment to the Constitution which would say that the Congress has the right to overturn the courts. And I guess it'd have to be signed by the president. So that's where a branch of the government, or maybe it's just the Congress itself, I don't know. I haven't read his amendment, but he was telling me about it. So that's where you could have, again, set up a constitutional structure to check the court. Or you could do what people have asked me, well, would you enforce this unconstitutional act on the part of the Supreme Court? And my opinion is, I would resist supporting it. And so how would you do that from the federal level? Because the same-sex marriage decision was overturning state laws. It wasn't overturning a federal law. But there was a decision before the same-sex marriage case that dealt with federal law. It was on the Defense of Marriage Act. And the same theory the court developed in defense of marriage as they applied to the state marriage laws, which overturned all the state laws. So I would go back and look at the Defense of Marriage Act, which says that no state has to respect another state's marriage laws, that they can live by their own marriage laws. And if you wanted, as an example, I've talked to some pretty potent legal scholars on this, their recommendation would be to enforce the Defense of Marriage Act, to say that the Supreme Court acted unconstitutionally, beyond its authority, and contest the Supreme Court and say, no, we will continue to enforce the Defense of Marriage Act. And you can say, well, what What can the court do? Well, the answer is the court really can't do anything. I mean, what's the court going to say? They can have a leather lawsuit and they go to the court and coach said, yo, you can't do this. How can the court stop you? They can't. And you say, well, that's tyranny. No, tyranny is when an unaccountable, unelected group of folks impose a law and say you can't change it. That's tyranny. The opposite of tyranny is when a president says that the court is wrong and says to the American public, I'm not going to enforce this court order. Because what happens then? Well, the American people can throw him out of office and say, we don't agree with him. These Supreme Court justices are there for 30 years. You can't get rid of them. So I would rather have a president, as much as I don't like the president defying the Supreme Court, if they're defying the Supreme Court when the court acts unconstitutionally, then I think it's appropriate for the president to do that. Tough issue. I'm trying to see if I'm... Am I ready? And if you folks have to go, I certainly understand, but I'm not ready. Almost ready.
About a minute.
About a minute. So... Anybody have a lightning round quick question? Yeah, Mark has part of it is term limits on Supreme Court justices. To me, that would be a hard thing. First up, you'd have to get 2/3 of the House, 2/3 of the Senate, and get it then ratified by all the states. 38 states. I think that's unlikely to happen. It would be an enormous effort. And I'm not too sure that solves the problem. It's still they're not accountable to an electorate. They're just their term runs out. They can be reappointed, I guess. I don't know, but I think it's a lot of effort for a minimal gain.
But our Supreme Court is very liberal right now, so
depends on the issue. They're pretty divided. There's 4 liberals, 4 conservatives, and 1 in between. And on some issues he's conservative, on other issues he's terrible. So, yes.
How do you go about doing this? Oh, that's just one person. I mean, how do you rally everybody about this is what we have to do? What are you going to do?
I think one of the things that President Obama has done well is he was a very effective communicator, and I think he could have been a much more important and powerful president than he ever was, but his ideas were so far out of the mainstream. He had a hard time convincing the American public to go along. And he had no relationship with the Congress, no trust. But if you get a president who is a good communicator, someone who can go out and challenge the American public on ideas and have that debate in America as to what the future of our country should look like, you can begin to, if you're good at what you're doing, you can begin to form consensus. And it's hard because America is very divided ideologically today. But I think if you're smart and you pick your battles, and you put together plans and ideas that have some bipartisan support, you can do a lot of things as President of the United States. Okay, we're getting there.
They're coming back from the dip right now.
Okay.